Genesis 11, the 12th talk in a series in Genesis, was presented by David Crabtree on November 12, 2000 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2000. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed, in whole, for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We'll be looking at Genesis chapter 11. Last time we got into the genealogies in Genesis, following the flood. And it goes through Japheth, Ham, and Shem. Then it tells the story of the Tower of Babel. And then it begins again with the descendants of Shem. But this time it focuses in on just one line of descent in Shem and brings us down from Shem to eventually Abraham. Let me just read in chapter 11, verses 27 through 32, so I will only inflict a small amount of the genealogy on you. Now these are the records of the generations of Terah. Terah became the father of Abram, Nahor, and Haran, and Haran became the father of Lot. And Haran died in the presence of his father Terah in the land of his birth, in Ur of the Chaldeans. And Abram and Nahor took wives for themselves. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai, and the name of Nahor's wife was Milcah, the daughter of Haran, the father of Milcah and Iscah. And Sarai was barren, she had no child. And Terah took Abram his son, and Lot the son of Haran, his grandson, and Sarai his daughter-in-law, his son Abram's wife, and they went out together from Ur of the Chaldeans in order to enter the land of Canaan. And they went as far as Haran and settled there. And the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah died in Haran. I would like to take this point in the Genesis narrative to talk about some historical matters. The nice thing about this section is, up to now, the picture of the past that's painted by secular historians and anthropologists is so different from the picture that we see in the Bible. It's very difficult to see correlations between the two. But at this point, the biblical narrative kind of peeks out into history as the secular academics tell us. And so I would like to look at that history a little bit, talk about the environment in which Abram lived and what we know about that from extra-biblical sources. Now, there are a couple of reasons that I think this is important. The first is that in history, even as the secular academics tell it, it seems to me that the biblical account is over time being vindicated. And that's very important and encouraging. You need to understand that generally speaking, archaeologists and academics do not trust the Bible. The ones who do the archaeology in the ground in the ancient Near East and the ancient historians in universities and colleges all over the world basically distrust the biblical account. They assume that it is so full of inaccuracies that it can't even be looked to as help in gaining understanding of what happened. They will look at other documents and assume that they are true unless shown to be false. But with the Bible, their assumption is that it's false unless accidentally true. We used to know virtually nothing about the ancient Near East. All we knew was what the Greeks and Romans had preserved about the times prior to Greece and Rome. And those histories only went back to about the time of the Babylonian Empire. But they did not go back further into the cultures and kingdoms that had risen and fallen prior to that. So during the 1700s and most of the 1800s, it was assumed by many scholars who had been influenced by the Enlightenment and the biases, the anti-Christian biases of the Enlightenment, that most of the Old Testament was myth and there was no basis in fact. How could there have been an Ur of the Chaldeans, because we know of no such place from extra-biblical sources? But then archaeology was developed, and people began to unearth some of the architecture of the ancient Near East and find inscriptions, and those were deciphered, and suddenly it was learned that there was not just a little history before Babylon, but there was a lot of history before the Babylonian Empire. In fact, whole cultures had come into being and passed away before Babylon was even established. And one of those discoveries was the discovery of Sumer. Sumer is now thought to be the oldest civilization that has existed, and the main city in Sumer was Ur, spelled U-R. There are many Urs in the ancient world, but the Ur of the lower Mesopotamian area is known as the Ur of the Chaldeans, at least after the Chaldeans come into being. That's what it becomes called. So when it says that Abram came out of Ur of the Chaldeans, now it's saying it's talking about Abram coming out of a place that 100 years ago, a little more than 100 years ago, we didn't even know existed. And now it has been unearthed, and it has been fairly extensively studied. But it has been assumed in over the last century that much of the Bible is myth. As they have carried on the archaeology, there's been no mention of anyone like Abraham, so he must be mythical. Ancient finds of the biblical text, so it must be a more recent creation. There isn't mention of the Israelites at all until we get past 1000 BC, so they must be of recent origin, etc., etc. And the older, 100 years ago, most scholars were steeped in the Bible, and in the Bible, these things are all central. Surely, as we're unearthing things in the ancient Near East, they would have been prominent then. And if we haven't found evidence of them, they must not be true. They must not have existed. Even now, some of the picture has changed, but even now, most secular historians would say that there was no Exodus. There was no conquest, or if there was a conquest, it happened very differently than the Bible describes it. There probably was no David, and there may have been no Solomon. So the attitude towards the Bible by the secular academics is extremely skeptical. However, as our knowledge of the ancient world increases, the grounds for skepticism, it seems to me, is being eroded away. That doesn't mean that the skepticism is being eroded away, but the grounds for the skepticism is being eroded away. Let me give you one example, one that is very has been very significant in my thinking. In the early 1900s, it was assumed, it was commonly said, that the King's List that can be found in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Samuel and in 1 and 2 Chronicles, that they were so riddled with inaccuracies that it was that those King Lists were one of the best evidences of the unreliability of the biblical text. They just didn't seem to fit together. You couldn't make them fit together with themselves, and you couldn't make them fit together with any of the secular data. There was a fellow in the 1950s, Edwin Thiel, who had a basic trust in the Bible, assumed that it was correct, and decided that he would investigate this question and see if the problems could be resolved. So he began to look at the surrounding cultures to see how they kept King Lists, to see if that could shed any light on the King Lists in the Old Testament. What he discovered is different cultures did it differently. And I'll just list some of the ways in which they did it differently. One question. And if you're familiar with the King List, it will say so-and-so reigned for so many years. And then the next king reigned for so many years. And the next king reigned for so many years. So there isn't, dates are not attached to these kings. It is just a relative chronology rather than an absolute chronology. Edwin Thiel looked at the surrounding cultures to see how they kept King Lists. One of the things that he noticed is that oftentimes, someone would become a king in mid-year. Now, does that year, does it count towards the old king, or does that that year count towards the new king? In some cultures, they would give it to the new king. In other cultures, they would give it to both kings. Another issue. Sometimes, the son of a king would become a co-ruler before the father died. So when a king becomes a co-ruler, then his years overlap with his father's. To which king do we give those years? In some cultures, they would give it to the old king, and in some cultures, they would give it to both kings. Another issue, when is New Year? In some cultures it was in the spring, and in other cultures it was in the fall. And since they only counted whole years in their king's lists, it made a difference when you started your year. Okay, so Edwin Thiel looked at all this stuff and assimilated it, and what he discovered is that in the king lists of the northern kingdom Israel and in the southern kingdom Judah, they would keep their king lists in the manner of the culture that they were most closely identified with at the time. If they were closely allied with Egypt at the time, they would keep their king lists the way the Egyptians kept it. If they were closely allied with the Syrians at the time, then they would keep their king lists the way the Syrians did it. And the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom had different alliances at different times. So by examining all the other king lists and their surrounding cultures, Edwin Thiel was able to figure out all of the anomalies, except there is one verse that he has yet to account for, but that's otherwise, he's accounted for all of the anomalies, and not only that, he can now tell us rather precisely with which country the kingdoms of Israel were allied at any given time by how they were keeping their king's list. When he first came out with his solution to the problem, it was scoffed at by many. But I have noticed that quietly over the last, and he did this in the 1950s, quietly in the last probably 25 years, it has just been assumed that his solution is correct. There was no fanfare, no big announcement, no mea culpa. It's just been assumed, and now if you read the literature, everybody accepts the chronology that he came up with. The thing that I find so fascinating about that is here was one individual who, instead of looking at the Bible and saying there is a superficial problem here, therefore the Bible is riddled with errors. Now let's go on to other sources of information. Edwin Thiel looked at the apparent problems and said, let's give it its fair day in court. Let's see if we can make sense of this. And having done that, he was able to make sense of it. It fits in very well. Not only is it internally consistent, but it also seems to coincide well with the chronologies of Egypt and of Syria. I'm convinced that similar kinds of persistence and giving the Bible the benefit of the doubt are going to provide similar kinds of results with respect to both the Exodus and with respect to the conquest of Israel, both of which are very hot topics in archaeology right now. They're being very vigorously debated. And there are some people who have stepped forward making some very good arguments that would interpret the evidence in a way that vindicates the Bible. It is very important to understand that much of doing archaeology is interpreting the evidence, and that requires judgment. And one's biases can affect one's judgment. There is one breakthrough that I am eagerly anticipating. I think that someday this is going to happen. Throughout the ancient Near East, in many of the cultures that have been discovered, libraries have been found. They used to write on clay tablets. They would use a stylus to poke into the clay, and then those clay tablets would dry, and it is a fairly permanent record. In the warfare of the ancient Near East, it was not uncommon when one people would attack a city of another people and burn it to the ground, that those libraries would burn down with the city, and the shelves on which the clay tablets generally were placed were wood. So by sacking a city, they preserved a library because it baked the clay. Those clay tablets have been found virtually without any deterioration at all and are very readable. So we have whole libraries have been found in a number of the cities that have been unearthed in recent times. We know that Israelite culture was very literate, and yet no significant findings have been made of written material. And I'm confident that it's just a matter of time until such a find is made. And when such a find is made, I think that's going to open up a lot of mysteries. It's going to resolve a lot of mysteries that we now have. In any case, I think it's important for us to realize that progress is being made towards vindicating the biblical account If you were to read scholars 100 years ago, their skepticism of the biblical text, academics in general, their skepticism of the text, the biblical text was amazing. But that has been dissipating. I shouldn't say the skepticism is dissipating, but the grounds for the skepticism has been dissipating. The things that they used to point to as saying this is proof of the unreliability of the biblical text, many of those have been taken away from them. And I'm really confident that that will continue. And the skepticism will be shown for what it really is, and that is an unwillingness to believe, not an absence of grounds for belief. The other issue, the other reason that I think it's important to talk about history is because knowing the history and the context of a written work is essential for understanding the work itself. Any author, as he's writing, assumes that the reader brings to that some knowledge. He has a picture in his mind of what his reader already knows. And he writes his account accordingly. If he assumes that his reader knows a lot, there are many things that he skips in his account. If he assumes that there's a lot that his reader does not know, then he includes a lot more detail. Think of an example. Let's say that you are writing a letter to a relative of yours who has been out of the country for the last month. And you are explaining they have no access to CNN. You are explaining to this relative what happened in the elections. Okay. Now, you have to write another account. And this time, you are writing to someone who has never been to America. It's someone who was born and raised in Russia. Just think how your account would be different. You may have to explain what a butterfly ballot is. In fact, you may even have to explain what the voting procedure is. You may have to explain what parties are. You may have to explain our legal system. There's a chore. I mean, just think of all of the things that you would have to explain that if you were writing to a relative, an American, you wouldn't have to go into at all. So knowing what the author expected the reader to know is critical. It's very, very important. In this case, the author of Genesis was writing to people who knew a lot more about the ancient Near East than we do. Knew much more about Ur, knew much more about Sumer, knew much more about Mesopotamia and the culture than we do. So it is to our advantage to bring ourselves up to speed, to try to learn as much as we can of what the author expected the reader to already know. As a point of interest, at Gutenberg College, we had a team come and visit, a site visitation team come as a part of the process towards accreditation. And one of the criticisms in the report that was written by the site visitation team was that we spend so much time in the first 2 years of our curriculum talking about the history of Western civilization, talking about the historical context in which the works that we are studying were written. From our perspective, having been involved in biblical interpretation, we realize how important the historical context is to understanding a work. So to our minds, historical context is critical. They are arguing that some works are of such a nature that they transcend historical context. They can be read in their own right. You don't have to know the history of the time period. That is unfathomable to me. Every writing is a product of its culture in one way or another. And every author is assuming a certain amount of knowledge about the culture when he's writing to people in his culture. So that is an issue of philosophical disagreement we have with the AALE, and we'll take up in our next response to them. Okay, for that reason then, let's look at the history of Sumer. I have, at the last minute, I decided to just make a photocopy of my outline for this section on one side of that sheet, and on the other side I have a map. Just briefly, let's look at the map. I didn't have a map for you last week. I don't know if you had access to a map, but here we can all talk about the same map, and that will be helpful. Notice in the bottom right-hand corner, that's the Persian Gulf. What it shows here is the coastline that exists right now. That coastline used to be further northwest. If you notice Ur was not far from the coast in ancient times. So that much land has been filled in by the silt carried down by the rivers. The area between those two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris, that is the area that is called Mesopotamia. Mesopotamia means the between the rivers. That is a plain. It's quite flat, and much of it is quite arid. It's not really desert, but it's quite arid. If you go to the northeast from the Tigris, you quickly rise into mountains. It goes up into mountains and then levels off on a plateau. If you go to the southwest from the Euphrates, you rapidly enter into what is real desert. Very, very little rainfall. Okay, if you look clear to the left-hand side of the map, you see the Mediterranean Sea reaching into our map. And you can see the Dead Sea, the Jordan River, and the Sea of Galilee there next to the Mediterranean Sea on the west side of the map, just below Hazor. So that's Palestine. Just north of Palestine is what would be modern-day Lebanon. The area around Haran would be modern-day Syria. And the area of Mesopotamia is part of Iraq right now. The highlands to the northeast of Iraq is present-day Iran. And the desert area to the southwest of Babylon is Saudi Arabia. Okay? So I hope that helps you orient yourself. Then, that was the leading city in Sumer. Sumer is a name that's used to describe the culture that developed in that the lower part of the Mesopotamian Valley. There is Larsa, Isin. Those were three of the main cities of Sumer. There were about five or six large city-states that were part of Sumer. So when we talk about Sumer, that's the area that we're talking about. When we talk about Akkad, we move a little bit northwest. up into the area around Babylon and Sippar and Eshnunna, that area. Okay. As I have mentioned, then, you can look at the, I'll follow the outline now on the other side. As I've mentioned before, Sumer is considered to be the earliest known civilization. And by civilization, what they mean is city-based society. Urban. It's the first urban society. It's the first society in which all of the activities were centered around and orchestrated by city life. It is in Sumer that we have the earliest known writing, which was developed in about 3500, which is the date that they give for the emergence of Sumer as a civilization. They also developed irrigation. I mentioned that last week. They had a surprisingly comfortable lifestyle. They had comfortable houses, which were made of brick and covered with adobe on the inside. They had several rooms for every house. They had furnishings for those houses, furnishings much like they still use in the ancient or in the Near East. A few tables and chairs, but largely they used pillows and carpets to recline on. In Sumer, they first used wheeled carts, and they rolled those wheeled carts on streets that were paved in some cases. They had a sewer system under those streets, and in some of the wealthier houses, they actually had running water. So city life in these places was quite comfortable. They were, at that time, very wealthy, relatively speaking. One of the reasons Sumer was so wealthy is because the land in that part of Mesopotamia produced so much barley in particular. Barley was their main crop, and they were able to raise three times the amount of barley per acre more than any other of the cultures of the ancient Near East. So for them to produce a lot of food was much easier than it was in other parts of the ancient world. As a result, they were very wealthy, and that created their luxury as well as their a malaise that entered in that comes along with that wealth. Sumerian culture reigned supreme in the ancient Near East for a very long time, and that's important to understand. Ur and Sumer were the dominant culture for well over 1,000 years, for about 1,500 years, unrivaled for that long. There were other cultures that were emerging farther away. Egypt comes into prominence in about 2000. And we have advanced cultures developing in India about 2000. But until about 2000, there is no culture that rivals Sumer. Because they were so wealthy, and because Sumer became such an attractive place, there were waves of immigrations of non-Sumerians into Sumer. And most of these came from the upper Mesopotamian region. And these peoples were, for the most part, Semitic. They spoke Semitic languages. And apparently, the Semites were very prolific in that area. They kept having trouble with overpopulation. In Sumer, they were not having a problem of overpopulation. They had a great deal of wealth. And so these Semites would move down to where the economy was very active, where there was lots of opportunity to work, and one could live much more comfortably than they could in the upper Mesopotamian region. So this phenomenon is much like in the history of America. There have been waves of immigrants who have come to America from different places at different times. Between the world wars, for instance, most of our immigrants were coming from Europe. In more recent times, most of our immigrants are coming from Mexico or South America. So at different times, the waves would come from different places, but it's generally the same impetus behind it all. America has been a very vibrant economy with lots of wealth, and there are people elsewhere that would like to share in that, people who want to come from places where life is much more difficult economically, that want to take advantage of the vibrancy of an active economy. So the Semites moving into Sumer are similar to, I'll use the analogy of immigrants coming to the United States. Notice that some of those immigrants, when they come, assimilate very quickly and very thoroughly. Many of the immigrants who came between the world wars, they came and it was very important to them that their children grow up speaking English without an accent. They wanted to assimilate as quickly as they possibly could and become indistinguishable from the Americans that were already here. Other peoples that come are more resistant to that. They're more interested in retaining some of their own culture to one degree or another, but still participating in the life of the place where they come, especially economically. And that will vary from one group to another for a variety of reasons. The waves of Semites that came into Sumer varied similarly. For the most part, the Semites that came in assimilated Sumerian culture very rapidly and very thoroughly. That is generally the case. However, later in the time period, towards the end of Sumer, and I'll talk about the end of it in just a little bit, but towards the end times, the immigrants that came down were less interested in adopting Sumerian culture as their own wholesale. They would take bits and pieces of it. Okay, let me briefly go through the main historical periods of Sumer. First, the early dynastic period from 2900 to 2334. This is the period of time when Sumer is basically unrivaled in its cultural dominance of the world. During this time, Sumer was never really united in spirit. It was united in culture, but there was a lot of fighting between the city-states. There were five or six main city-states. They fought amongst themselves constantly. And from time to time, one city-state would rise to dominance over the others and coordinate the whole. But they only kept it together by force, and eventually their hold would loosen and some other city-state would rise up and take control. So there was always a lot of conflict in Sumer. In 2334, a predominantly Semitic area around Akkad, and that's the area on your map that's just northwest of Sumer proper. I have to find my map. The area around Babylon and Sippar. That area is predominantly Semitic, but they are thoroughly Sumerian in culture. And during this time period, they become the dominant political force in Sumer, and that's the Akkadian period. and that lasts for about a little over 100 years. While they are in power, they decide to expand the political boundaries, the area that Sumer controls. And they expand it from the Persian Gulf all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. That all comes under the control of the Akkadians. Their power, however, was briefly overthrown by some tribespeople coming down from the mountains, the highlands, to the northeast. They were the Gudi. They did not really control Sumer. They basically harassed Sumer and kept things in turmoil for a period of about 100 years. Then the Sumerians were able to throw that off and reemerge as a political power. And that period of time is called Ur III. It's from 2100 to about 2000. During this time, Ur and Sumer were very prosperous once again. However, during this time, state control began to erode a bit. And private citizens came to have control of extensive tracts of land, which had never been true previously. Previously, only the state had controlled the large tracts of land. But during this period of time, state control is starting to slip away. And a wave of immigrants comes down from the upper Mesopotamian region called the Amorites. These are Semitic. And they come down, some of them thoroughly becoming assimilated, but others kind of staying on the fringes of Sumerian culture and not being thoroughly assimilated. Then in about 2000, Sumer is invaded by a group of people again from the northeast, the Elamites. And the Elamites just come in, sack the place, and basically leave. But because of that disruption, Sumerian culture can never pull itself back together again. There is absolute chaos. No city-state can gain control over the region. There are numerous invasions of nomadic tribes from the surrounding regions. Agriculture is in decline both because of the chaos and a problem that's been building over a number of years, and that is an increase in the amount of salt in the soil. They have been so intensively farming those areas with irrigation that they have been spreading salt onto those fields, and the crop harvest decreased significantly. Now, what was this time period like in Sumer? It seems to me, as I envision it, it's much like what has happened in Russia in modern times. I spent some time studying in Leningrad during the Soviet period. When I was there, if you were in the central city area, as long as you weren't in the suburbs, if you're in the central city area, which is a large area, it was safe any day, any time of day or night, which is good because their nights are long. You could walk around and feel perfectly safe anytime. And even women could walk around safe at night. In the suburbs, that was not so true, but in the city area, that was true. There were policemen all over the place. The way they kept order was lots of force. They had to use so much force, I'm convinced that that's part of what bankrupted the Soviet Union. But at least things worked and there was not chaos. The chaos was kept back by force. It's not a very cost-effective way of keeping back the chaos, but it can work. After the fall of the Soviet Union, I went back again to what was then renamed St. Petersburg, and I was I had thought when I was in Leningrad during the Soviet period, if this place were just liberated from Soviet control, this would be a wonderful place. So when I went back after the fall of the Soviet Union, I went back with a certain amount of eager anticipation of being able to see this place that I really liked being, where I liked being, where I liked the people, but just wished I could see it without that oppressive rule. And when I went back after the fall of the Soviet Union, I was literally depressed for several days to see what a state the country had fallen into. It was depressing, very depressing. Nothing worked. The streets, there was no litter in the Soviet Union. The streets were always clean. But I went back this time and it was filthy. Buildings falling apart. Traffic lights sometimes would work, some of them wouldn't work. Nobody was fixing them. Nobody was fixing anything. The heating system wasn't great in the Soviet period, but after the fall of the Soviet Union, there wasn't heat. There was no hot water the whole time I was there. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The whole thing was kind of falling apart, and it was not safe. I would be walking during the daytime in the center of St. Petersburg, in places where I had been safe, felt very safe in the Soviet period. Now, after the Soviet power was gone and there was nothing to replace it. Just as a side note, we as Americans, I don't think, appreciate how fragile social order is. It really doesn't take an awful lot to undermine good social order. And once undermined, it's difficult to recover. And I think about that with respect to our elections here. I don't know what's going to happen, but I hope that people on all sides realize how valuable good civic order is and how fragile it is. It can be easily destroyed. I assume that the environment in Sumer after the fall of Ur 3 was like that kind of chaos. They had been used to living life in a very orderly fashion, with public services taken care of, an economy that works, and all that sort of thing. And in a very short period of time, all of that collapses. And it degenerates into chaos and mob rule. That's essentially what happened in the Soviet Union. As a result, large numbers of people begin to flee, go elsewhere from Sumer. And many of those people, being Semitic, decide to go back to the upper Mesopotamian region, the region from which their ancestors had come. And apparently, Abraham fits into that pattern, that he's fleeing the chaos of that exists in the area that had for centuries and centuries been the most wealthy and the culturally dominant society in the world. That has all collapsed, and he's fleeing the chaos and going to where life is more ordered and one can live in peace. Okay, when did Abraham live? That is debatable, but I will just go through the reasoning that is spelled out here. First of all, Solomon began construction on the temple in Jerusalem in 967 BC. Just a little anecdote with respect to that. About 20 years ago, I was studying at PBC and studying under David Roper, who at the time was working on a master's degree in, I can't remember what the name of it, but basically he was studying the ancient Near East. And in this verse, in 1 Kings 6:1, where it talks about the construction of the temple, he said, we know when that began. It began in, and you can write this in your Bible in pen, he told us. So I did. 970 BC is what he told us. That has now been amended by in a recount, a manual recount, and it's now 967. Okay, but that's relatively firm, 967. 1 Kings 6:1, if you look it up, tells us that the construction began 480 years after the Exodus, so after the Israelites left Egypt. If you look at Exodus 12:40, it says that the period of time that the Israelites lived in Egypt is what the Masoretic text says, what is considered to be the most reliable text in Hebrew says, the time that the Israelites lived in Egypt was 430 years. Okay. However, LXX stands here for the Septuagint. That is a translation of the Old Testament from Hebrew into Greek that happened around between 300 and 200 BC. Also, the Samaritan Pentateuch, that would be another version of the Old Testament that was retained by the Samaritans. I won't go into all of that stuff, but just suffice it to say that there are ancient versions that say something else there. Instead of Egypt, they say Egypt and Canaan. So the question is, are we talking about the time period in which the Israelites, that is, Jacob and his descendants, were in Egypt itself, or are we talking about the period of time in which they were in both Canaan and then later in Egypt? That's the question. If it is that 430 years accounts for Canaan and Egypt, we know that Abram left Haran for Canaan at age 75. Then we can establish when Abram was born. And you can see the tabulation there. It comes out 1952 BC. Now, if you look on the other side, I said it is debatable. There are three different views that are graphed out here. These are views of scholars who, rare scholars, who accept the biblical account as being basically reliable. And you can see the differences. Kitchen and Mitchell take the 430 years to mean just Egypt, but they do something else with the period of time between the Exodus and the temple. And Rasmussen pushes Abram's birth even further into the past. Okay. It seems, for a variety of reasons that I will not go into, it seems to me most reasonable that Abram was born in 1952. If that's true, then his birth is just before things get really bad in Sumer. It's just after the fall of Sumer, but before things have gotten really bad. And if that's the case, then he and his father, apparently it is father's initiative, they leave Sumer and go up to Haran. They're going up to a place that apparently is the place where Terah's ancestors had lived. So they're going back, in a sense, to their homeland. And that's where they settle. Okay, very quickly. There are a number of implications from this that I think are worth our note. The first is, there had been a lot of history before Abraham. Abraham was not at the beginning of history. Abraham was well into the history. Whole civilizations had, whole kingdoms had come and fallen before Abram was even born. Secondly, Abraham was from a very advanced culture, the most advanced culture of the world at the time. So when they move from Sumer, they're going from Los Angeles to what? Someplace in Mexico? It's kind of like the frontier. Then later, when Abram goes from Haran, he goes to Canaan, which is like the Wild West. It's even less civilized. Abram and Terah they moved from an urban environment to a semi-nomadic environment. So they're having to relearn how to do everything. They're learning to live off the land. They're learning to raise livestock. They probably did not do that in Sumer. It's possible that they did, but they probably didn't. Thirdly, Abraham was thoroughly Sumerian in culture. His father, we know from Joshua 24:2, was a polytheist, believed in the gods of Sumer. The names of the people in the family indicate that they worshiped the Sumerian gods. So Abram was not drawn from a protected, faithful line that goes back to Noah. Abram is being selected out of, it's like random, out of the people of the earth at that time. It is quite likely that Abram himself was a polytheist. The text does not say for sure, but it seems to me that that's quite likely. Interestingly, in Sumerian religion, they had 4,000 gods in their pantheon, approximately. The priests were paid to serve these gods on a regular basis, and much of their income went to taxes to pay for the service of the gods. The Sumerians were very superstitious. They were constantly looking for omens as to what they should do and what they should not do, and very interested in fortune telling. So with this vast array of gods, none of whom you could expect to pay much attention to you individually, and with this sense of superstition where you're always on the lookout for signs as to what would be a good thing to do and what would be a bad thing to do, it was a very impersonal and scary world. It's a world in which there are a lot of forces out there that could absolutely destroy you, and you have no place to turn that you can count on getting help. However, in Sumerian culture, there was this one other part of their religion that developed late in their culture, and these are these little gods. They're private gods, in a sense. They would have their own god that they would worship in their household, and that one god would take care of their well-being. Let me read you a section from, this is a book, The Sumerians. It's one of the classics on on Sumer by Samuel Noah Kramer. And I'll just read one short section from here about these personal gods. He says, "But will the gods give heed to him, a lone and not very effective mortal, even if he prostrates and humbles himself in heartfelt prayer? Probably not," the Sumerian teachers would have answered. As they saw it, gods were like mortal rulers and no doubt had more important things to attend to. And so, as in the case of kings, man must have an intermediary to intercede on his behalf, one whom the gods would be willing to hear and favor. As a result, the Sumerian thinkers contrived and evolved the notion of a personal god, a kind of good angel to each particular individual and family head, his divine father who had begot him, as it were. It was to him, to his personal deity, that the individual sufferer bared his heart in prayer and supplication, and it was through him that he found his salvation. I don't know for sure that Abraham would have had this perspective, but he's coming from a culture that had this kind of perspective on religion and theology and the fact that there is such a concept is interesting in light of the text in Genesis. So what we have, the picture that we have in Genesis is that God comes along and he says, he picks a man basically at random. There's no reason why he picked Abram instead of his neighbor or his neighbor's neighbor. Apparently he's just picking someone at random, an everyman. And he decides to move in his life. He decides to act in his life in a very unique way. He decides that he is going to take Abram, and from Abram he is going to create a new nation, a nation of a special people selected for a special purpose by God. And that people is going to be the vehicle by which God is going to reveal himself most fully to the world. And he picks this man from the most advanced culture in the world at the time, but a culture that has fallen into chaos. So Abram has seen the best of what man has to offer, but he's seen that collapse. He's lost everything that he's grown up with, everything that's familiar to him. He's been uprooted, and God takes him out to the frontier lands, to Haran. And he spends years there. We don't know how many years there, but he spends years there. And then, as we'll see next week, in chapter 12, he calls him from there to Canaan. It's a really interesting story. It's amazing how God is working to bring about his purposes, and he's doing it by picking an ordinary person that he then elevates to a very, very important role in the unfolding of things. It is not at all amazing to me that of all the documents that have been found in the ancient Near East, that none of them mentions Abraham. Why should it? That's not what the Bible is describing. God did not come to the most prominent man in the world at the time. He picked an everyman and works out his purposes through him. Okay, so we will... I have gone over time. If you have questions, please write them down, and I'll do questions next time. Thanks.